Glenn is not going to like this. Rob Cherry in for Glenn Mack now today with Mike Sielski for a Saturday morning. Mike, how are you?
I'm great, Rob. Good to be here with you.
It's now, we've never worked together, but you've been a guest on shows I've been on.
That is correct.
The morning show this week.
That is correct.
There is so much going on right now. It's unbelievable.
It's a great time of year. It really is. You know, college football is starting again. We got the NFL on the horizon. The Phillies are treating September so far like they've treated the last few Septembers. It's pretty cool.
That's what I wanted to start with, is the Phillies, because what it was scary what happened last night.
You know, going into that road trip that they're on now on the West Coast, Glenn and I had talked about this a couple of weeks ago. You say to yourself, okay, they've basically got a month where they're not going to face a team that's over 500.
Except for the Braves at some point.
Right, yeah. In the middle of September. So you should be able to solidify yourself in the playoff race, maybe put some distance between yourself and the San Diego Padres, kind of solidify that second wild card, maybe even chase the Braves if you have delusions of grandeur. And you lose 2 out of 3 to the Diamondbacks. You come into San Francisco and get blown out 13-1. And this is 3 out of the last 4 games that they've surrendered double-digit runs. This is insane.
And their starting pitching has been brutal. So here's how last night went for me. I'm not sure how it went for you. There was a riveting tennis match between Serena Williams and what was her opponent's name?
Isla Tomljanovic.
At this point, it doesn't matter who it is because everybody's rooting against her.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel bad for whoever's playing them, but I think they're even rooting for Serena.
I heard somebody describe the last two matches that Serena played. Anytime one of her opponents would get a point, there was a golf clap in Arthur Ashe Stadium. And that's true. I mean, the crowds were so partisan for Serena, and understandably so. It's probably the last time she'll play in the U.S. Open. She's nearing retirement. The sentiment is there, and that's the way that crowd at that event acts. We've seen it in the past with Jimmy Connors and other people like that.
If you walk out of the room, which I did several times during there, it was a long, it was like close to 3 hours,
yeah.
I think. You walk out of the room, you hear applause, wild applause, you know that Serena won. If you hear, you know, the golf clap, it's the
exactly.
Other girl wins a point. And, you know, everybody was acknowledging how great she is and mm-hmm. appreciates her greatness, even those who are tired. I mean, when somebody wins a lot, at times you get tired. It's like, well, let's get somebody new in here.
Yeah.
No matter who it is.
Yeah, that's true. But the flip side of that is that the lion and winner coming back to make a charge late in his or her career is one of the most compelling stories in sports. You know, the idea of Tom Brady, I know he's a villain around here, I get that, but to have him win another Super Bowl with the Buccaneers, there's something interesting and dramatic about that.
It's a story that everybody sort of can relate to. It's like, well, this person was supposed to be washed up, supposed to retire, whatever, and they're still out there doing what they're doing.
There's a reason that Top Gun Maverick has made $1 billion in theaters this summer. Part of it is for that reason. I think it's Tom Cruise and the character, like, he's old, is he still an ace kind of thing? And if you've seen that movie, it's a very dramatic storyline. I think we, as a society, kind of like that narrative.
No, I didn't see every second of the match, but I understand Ben Simmons' picture came up on the video board, big board.
Apparently the only boos that have taken place in the entire
How do they know?
Tournament. You know, it didn't take him long up there in Brooklyn to kind of reveal what we had seen in Philadelphia since his time joining the Sixers.
They asked him to play in Game 4. Are you ready? And he said no.
No. No.
Didn't even want to be on their little team meeting or whatever.
It's funny. I'll listen sometimes to people on TV, you know, national NBA coverage, whether it's ESPN or Fox Sports, things like that. And you hear people say things like, well, if, you know, look at the Nets. If you have Kevin Durant and if Kyrie Irving gets his head right and if Ben Simmons is there, Ben Simmons isn't going to have to take any jump shots if you have Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. It's kind of like, you know, at some point, folks, you have to evaluate what you're seeing regularly from this team. And the idea that the Brooklyn Nets are going to be a team to be reckoned with just strikes me as kind of, you know, pie in the sky, ridiculous thing.
Doesn't Ben Simmons still have a high ceiling if he ever devotes himself to learning how to shoot or practicing shooting?
I don't know, Rob. I really don't. I mean, in theory, yes, but he hasn't done it yet. I mean,
but he's only 26 years old?
Yeah. I mean, but everybody knew this thing about him and has known this thing about him for years. I can remember talking to his father before Game 6 of the Sixers-Raptors series back in 2019 at the Wells Fargo Center, and I asked Dave Simmons point blank, what about the fact that Ben won't shoot? And his father said, don't worry about it. He's 22. He's 23. He's young. Just enjoy it. It's such an honor that he gets to guard Kawhi Leonard in this series. And I was kind of like, okay, I guess. And he's made no progress, and if anything, regressed since then.
And Kawhi Leonard hit that shot over Ben Simmons.
Yeah, yeah, and Joel Embiid. So it's, yeah, here we are.
Well, the most damning thing I ever heard him say, and it was, I think there were only a few reporters around, I don't know if it was a practice or whatever, but they asked him what if he needed to work on his shooting in the offseason, whatever, something like that. And his response was, I'm an all-star.
Yeah. Yeah, that's our friend Jack McCaffrey from the Delco Times.
I'm an all-star is his response to you need to work on my shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, he's a different cat in that, you know, I think he's, and I actually wrote a column about this in the Inquirer a couple of weeks ago. Like, he's a case study in, like, there were red flags all over the place with him, but it became conventional wisdom to think, well, they don't matter or they won't matter, and here's why he should be the first pick in the draft. And it became very easy to overlook the fact that, for instance, LSU took a step backward with him from the previous season, or that he would score a lot of points and collect a lot of rebounds and LSU would still lose, or that in Australia he wasn't playing against a really high level of competition compared to, say, the AAU and high school and college teams that kids who were born and grow up in the States do. So, you know, you get this kind of collective narrative of, well, he's going to be the first pick in the draft because everybody says he's going to be the first pick in the draft and that he should be. And then you end up with these weaknesses that never get corrected. And only in hindsight can you look back and say, oh, well, we should have seen this coming.
Well, who knew that his work ethic would be like, I'll work on everything else, but I won't work on this.
Right, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. It was the one thing. And you know, you wonder about him from that mental health standpoint. I know we're all skeptical, and rightly so, of it. But there's clearly something there where he does not want to shoot the ball. And that's a
mental health thing.
Yeah.
That's something that's mental if you're not wanting to shoot.
It's Steve Sachs' disease of basketball.
Which very few people... And we've seen it with guys shooting free throws.
Right.
We generally don't see it with guys shooting jump shots.
Right. Yeah, that's 100% right. But, I mean, and that's the thing, right? It's anybody, any layperson watching a basketball game can see Ben Simmons and see his speed, see the way he handles the ball, see the way he passes the ball, and say, boy, if he only would shoot the ball, imagine the player he would be. And that's what I think at its core frustrated so many people during his tenure here, was you can see how great he will become, could become, and he's not tapping into that, and he seemingly just refuses to do so.
He has four superior skills. It's the fifth that he just doesn't want to work
on. Yeah, it's a shame.
All right, so anyway, so he gets booed at the Open. The Open ends, and I don't know, but I stayed around for the interviews because I wanted to hear what Serena had to say. I actually wanted to hear what her opponent had to say about Serena because it was so fascinating.
I didn't stay for the – I'm down the shore this weekend in Seattle City. My kids were in bed. I needed to get to bed. So I didn't stay for the interviews. Were they compelling?
Yeah, I mean, Serena, to me, at this point of her career, or at the end of her career, just to hear what an athlete has to say about the end and hear her thank all these different people, it's just, and you've never seen, you haven't seen the movie about King Richard.
No, I haven't.
Which was a fascinating movie. Mm-hmm. Just to hear, like, the end of her career, to me, it's like, it's a historical thing.
Yeah, the one thing I did hear her say was that she thanked Venus for her role in Serena's success, which was really touching to me, you know, that I have two sons and I want them to be close. I want them to be best friends. And the fact that Serena and Venus seem to have that relationship, which is not necessarily an easy thing, given that Serena, the younger sister, eclipsed the older sister as a player. That touched me to hear her say that.
Yeah, it was a very touching. And she obviously was, Serena was emotional, but then they go to Venus and she's not. I'm like, well, there's got to be a reason behind that.
Maybe she just knows the cameras are on her and she's trying not to take from her sister's moment.
That could be. So anyway, so that ends, and the Phillies game is on. So and it's on Apple TV, which is not the easiest thing to find.
No.
You have to either have Apple TV, have to have a laptop or Mac or whatever. So I turned that on, and it's 4-0 already.
Ooh.
And then it's 7-0. Jock Peterson hits a 3-run homer. And then it's like, what the hell is going on with this team?
Yeah. Pitching. And the irony of this is that people seem to think, and justifiably so, that that would be a strength for the Phillies coming down the stretch.
Starting pitching.
Starting pitching, you had Wheeler and Nola.
And Suarez.
And Rangers have been a solid number three starter. And Dave Dombrowski had fortified the bullpen. He had gone out and gotten David Robertson. And you thought, okay, he got Noah Syndergaard, you know, who may or may not start a game in the playoffs, assuming the Phillies get there. But at least he can help you get there every fifth or sixth day.
And he looked solid, except for the last game. He's looked solid in all of his starts.
Yeah. And now they've just hit this patch, you know, the first two games of the Diamondbacks series and last night against the Giants, where it might as well be slow pitch softball out there. It is scary.
So is this the beginning of the end? Or was last night confirmation that, you know, this is it? This is where they're headed right now. We're going to get another September where we're disappointed.
I think everybody is, you know, cynical about this, and justifiably so. The Phillies have not been good the last three or four Septembers. You know, you go back to 2018 when the guy who beat them last night, Gabe Kapler, was their manager.
They were like 14 games over 500 in the summer, and yes, then by September, it was starting to fall apart.
Yeah, it really was. And they were, what, 14 and 16, I think, in September and October last year. Got swept by the Braves in that critical series where, even though Bryce Harper was rightly the MVP, he didn't hit in that one series, and it kind of hurt a little bit. Not to take anything away from the season he had, but, you know, that was the most important series of the season. Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say to the Phillies, you got to show us, guys. You know, yeah, a number of you haven't been here the last few years, Kyle Schwarber, Nick Castellanos, guys like that, but the most of you have, and it's time to play like you're in a pennant race and it doesn't bother you. Something seems to happen to this team come September.
Right, you mentioned Bryce Harper. I believe they were 32 and 20 or 33 and something like that when he was out.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to get better when he comes back. What I mean, seriously, yeah. What's happened?
Well, Castellanos missed a couple games with turf toe. And look, Bryce Harper can go up there and go 4-for-4 every night. If your pitchers are going to give up 13 runs each night, you're going to have a hard time winning games. So Rob Thompson said after last night's game, you know, this is a blip. We will get out of this. This is just one of those stretches in a baseball season where things go haywire and they'll eventually stabilize themselves again. Maybe he's right, but I can understand the anxiety that Phillies fans are feeling right now, because it looks like, at least after last night, oh my gosh, it's September and here we go again.
All right, I got to ask you about the pitching. Aaron Nola, obviously his last start was hideous.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody talks about September with it. Last year, it seemed like it was all throughout the season. Sprinkled throughout the season, he had games like that where he melted down. Is this it? Is this what he is now?
Look, there's an argument to be made that Aaron Nola is underrated. If you look at the totality of his career with the Phillies, that the number of innings he pitches, his ERA, his walks and hits per innings pitched, you know, the numbers that really count for a starting pitcher, generally compared to other starters in the National League, he's really, really good. But there's also no denying the fact that he has not pitched like an ace at any time during September when the team has been in contention. So, again, I would say the same thing about Nola that I say about the Phillies as a whole. It is on him and them to prove to the people who follow them that they are ready for prime time. And his last start brings all those questions back up. It just does.
The baseball draft began in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, the two best pitchers they've drafted, starting pitchers they've drafted, are Cole Hamels and Aaron Nola.
There you go.
In how many years is that? 57 years?
Yeah.
Those are the two best pitchers they've drafted.
Yeah.
Why can't this team draft pitchers?
I mean, look at their history. They have precious few periods where they draft well at all. You had, you know, the late 60s into the early 70s with Paul Owens, and, you know, where they draft Schmidt and they get Boa.
Buzynski.
You know, yeah, that young core. And then you have the Mike Arbuckle era, you know, where he's leading the scouting staff and they're able to draft, you know, they draft Chase Utley and Jimmy Rollins and Ryan Howard and Hamels, and you get Ryan Madsen and you find Carlos Ruiz, and before you know it, you're celebrating a World Series and five straight division titles. And it's been pretty barren, all things considered, since then. And look, Rob, this is a team that this season, a franchise, won its 10,000th game in its history.
And they've got over 11,000 losses.
They lost their 10,000th game 15 years ago.
We celebrated that. And that was before they won a World Series, before they got good.
Yeah.
Really good.
2007, they lost their 10,000th game. So the Phillies are what they are. I grew up as a kid loving them. I've covered them for a long time. Not as much the last couple of years, but there's a reason why people kind of look to the sky every September for the anvil that's going to fall on their head. And there's a lot of history in that regard, and I'm sure people are feeling it this morning, too.
My childhood as well, 1964, when they collapsed in late September. All right, so the last question I have about the Phillies is, why hasn't attendance matched the way they've played this season? Is it because Phillies fans are skeptics and waiting for the sky to fall in and waiting for them to actually prove themselves?
I think that's part of it. Glenn and I have batted this around a bit the last couple of weeks. I think that's part of it. I think, at least this past week, speaking as a parent, my two kids were starting school again, so getting them to, you know, activities and stuff outside of anything related to school was not a high priority. If the Phillies had been in town, I wouldn't have taken them to, you know, anywhere, let alone a Phillies game. I think cost is an issue. I saw a report a couple of weeks ago from a tech reporting firm that ranked the average cost of a family of four to go to a Major League Baseball game based on the stadium and the team that you'd go to see. And the Phillies were kind of in the middle of the pack, but it was more than $200 for the tickets and parking and food and drinks and all of that stuff. So, and I do think your point is well taken, that there's skepticism. It is, okay, you know, we're not quite there yet. And the final wild card, I think, is that one of the big reasons that the 07 to 2011 teams were loved as much as they were was that their very best players were homegrown players. And Bryce Harper, people love him, but he's not a homegrown Philly. They didn't watch him grow up, so to speak. And I think that in baseball, that matters. I think it does.
So the fact that he's from Washington, even though Washington won a championship after he left, the fact that we hated him for a while, we can't, because Pete Rose came here in 1979, I guess it was. And look, we hated him as a Red. Mm-hmm. Dykstra came here and loved him as a Philly. Loved both these guys as a Philly. There's no love. And he got a standing O his first mm-hmm. week here. And
yeah, I'm not saying people don't love Bryce Harper. I'm just saying that those teams, the two Phillies teams that won championships, the 80 team and the 2008 team, people could grow up with those teams in a way that they haven't been able to with these teams now. The Phillies went out and said, we're going to spend a lot of money and get some guys who can hit, and Zach Wheeler. And that's what they've done. And if I'm not saying that if they get to the playoffs, people won't be excited and all of that. But I am saying that there's something different about a team where you can watch, ooh, who's this kid, Ryan Howard? He's been hitting home runs in the minor leagues, and now he's up here. Chase Utley was the first round pick, and oh my gosh, his first major league hit is a grand slam. There's something kind of magical and sentimental about having a team that's great, built around guys who you saw come up when they were young.
Yet we loved Jim Thome right away.
Oh, yeah.
People loved Jim Thome right away.
Yeah. Well, it was hard not to. A really good guy.
Yeah.
Really good
work ethic and all that stuff. So anyway, we'll get some Phillies conversation going. When we come back also, we're going to talk some Eagles and throw some things about the Eagles.
Sounds good. In
8 days?
Yeah. Yeah, a week from tomorrow.
In Detroit. And there's obviously questions about the Eagles, but there's a lot of answers as well.
Yeah, there are. I think they should be pretty good.
Rob Cherry in for Glenn Mack now with Mike Sielski. WIP Sports Time is 10:20.